Hello, this is Esperanza Phoenix, and welcome to Unpacking Life's Crazy, a podcast about a lifetime of unfortunate, unusual, and enlightening experiences, and how some of us use humor and hope to survive mental illness. In our podcast, we discuss controversial and adult topics. We are all adults here. There will be swearing. In today's pod, we get into the weeds about magic mushrooms. As always, nothing we discuss here today should be considered medical advice. The substances we are discussing today may be illegal in your jurisdiction. Using substances which fall under the federal Schedule 1 drug classification may have legal repercussions. It is my strong personal opinion that naturally growing medicinal herbs should never have been made illegal. To understand why I feel this way, let's get into these weeds. As you know, this podcast is called Unpacking Life's Crazy, and there's a very good reason for that. And one of the reasons is because I am diagnosed with several mental illnesses and a couple physical illnesses as well. So why am I so honest about my mental illness? I don't think that having a mental illness and talking about it is necessarily a confession. We really shouldn't feel any more ashamed of having depression than we would if we had arthritis or diabetes. Some of us, a lot of us, have underlying mental health issues, and understanding and accepting them is the way that we learn to deal with them and treat these disorders and hopefully improve our lives. So in my case, a lot of my suffering in life started with childhood trauma. I'm not going to go into the specifics of the traumatic experiences because that's not what this episode is about. But my first diagnosed mental illness was diagnosed when I was 14. When I was 14, I attempted suicide. And following that hospitalization, I was diagnosed with depression. I did receive some counseling, certainly not sufficient. It was only years later that I would actually get the counseling to realize that it wasn't just depression, but post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, the post-traumatic stress disorder that I have is different than that of, say, a soldier returning from a war zone. And there are psychiatrists who are trying to see that there is a separate designation given for those who have PTSD because of ongoing trauma. The proposed designation is complex post-traumatic stress disorder or complex trauma disorder. So what's the difference? I'm going to read you the definition of each so that you have a better understanding of what I'm talking about. According to the American Psychiatric Association, post-traumatic stress disorder is a psychiatric disorder that can occur in people who have experienced or witnessed a traumatic event such as a natural disaster, a serious accident, a terrorist attack, war, combat, rape, or other violent personal assault. PTSD has been known by many names in the past, such as shell shock during the years of World War I and combat fatigue after World War II. But PTSD does not just happen to combat veterans. PTSD can occur in all people of any ethnicity, nationality, or culture, and any age. PTSD affects approximately 3.5% of U.S. adults, and an estimated 1 in 11 people will be diagnosed with PTSD in their lifetime. Women are twice as likely as men to have PTSD. People with PTSD have intense, disturbing thoughts and feelings related to their experience that last long after the traumatic event has ended. They may relive the event with flashbacks or nightmares. They may feel sadness, fear, or anger, and they may feel detached or estranged from other people. People with PTSD may avoid situations or people that remind them of the traumatic event, and they may have strong negative reactions to something as ordinary as a loud noise or an accidental touch. A diagnosis of PTSD requires exposure to an upsetting traumatic event. However, exposure could be indirect rather than firsthand. For example, PTSD could occur in an individual learning about the violent death of a close family member. It can also occur as a result of repeated exposure to horrible details of a trauma. For example, this can happen to the family members of those who were victims of the Holocaust. So what is complex PTSD? Complex post-traumatic stress disorder is a condition where you experience some of the symptoms of PTSD along with some additional symptoms, such as difficulty controlling your emotions, feeling very hostile or distrustful towards the world, constant feelings of emptiness or hopelessness, feeling as if you are permanently damaged or worthless, feeling as if you are completely different from other people, feeling like nobody can understand what happened to you, avoiding friendships and relationships or finding them very difficult, often experiencing dissociative symptoms such as depersonalization or derealization, and regular suicidal feelings. Professionals have recognized for a while that some types of trauma can have additional effects to PTSD, but have disagreed about whether this is a form of PTSD or an entirely separate condition, and to what it should be called. If you have complex PTSD, you may be particularly likely to experience what some people call an emotional flashback, in which you have intense feelings that you originally felt during the trauma, such as fear, shame, sadness, or despair. You might react to events in the present as if they are causing these feelings without realizing that you are having a flashback. So what causes complex post-traumatic stress disorder? The types of traumatic events that can cause complex PTSD include childhood abuse, neglect, or abandonment, ongoing domestic violence or abuse, repeatedly witnessing violence or abuse, being forced to become a sex worker, torture, kidnapping, or slavery, being a prisoner of war. You are more likely to develop complex PTSD if you experience the trauma at an early age, the trauma lasted for a long time, escape or rescue were unlikely or impossible, you have experienced multiple traumas, or if you were harmed by someone close to you. In my case, that would be my parents. So I understood, I guess, that post-traumatic stress disorder is an anxiety disorder. It's hard to explain understanding that you have anxiety, because basically, I've had anxiety my entire life, and you don't know how other people think. You just assume that everybody else is dealing with the same level of anxiety and panic. And for years and years, I would marvel at the things that people did. Like, oh my gosh, how did they fill out those college forms? And boy, they're just so courageous. No, normal people apparently don't completely freak out when you put a form in front of them. I mean, like, I have test anxiety if you put the DMV form in front of me. I didn't realize how much the anxiety was affecting every aspect of my life, but it was. I had trouble driving. For a while, I worked as a bubbleologist. So basically, you do shows where you demonstrate different kinds of bubbles. You talk about the science of bubbles. So it's part science and part entertainment. It's a lot of fun for the kids, and I actually enjoyed doing it. The thing about the job that made it the hardest for me was driving to and from shows, because I have a tremendous amount of anxiety about driving, and I grew up in the country, so I'm not especially used to city driving to begin with. So in order to even make the job work, I was very restricted on my schedule. Like, I could not be scheduled to drive to a bubble show during rush hour. Leaving the show was fine because there was no pressure as to when I eventually got home. But as I was going to the show, I would be constantly stressed out about whether I would make it on time because of traffic. And when I say anxiety during driving, I mean imagining that everybody around me was like, watching how I drove. Am I driving too close to the car in front of me? Am I driving too far from the car in front of me? Should I move to the other lane and let the person behind me who's tailgating me go past me? And I mean, just every moment I'm on the road, I am constantly aware of everybody around me. And then heaven forbid, I should experience some sort of a traffic road rage incident, because that would put me off driving for several days. So anxiety is a weird thing. It's weird that you just become so incredibly preoccupied about everything, worrying about a conversation you had with somebody you didn't even know and being afraid that maybe they took something in the wrong context or maybe you offended them in some way. When I'm in a public place, I'm constantly aware of the people around me. Am I invading their space? Have I been standing too long in front of this particular shelf in the grocery store? And is the person behind me trying to get to something? So part of that is the trauma and being just hyper aware of absolutely everything. And another part of that is I startle very easily. I'm lucky I finally have a great, wonderful partner in life. And he actually makes an effort to hum or whistle as he's coming into the room, because he can come into the room and just scare the crap out of me. He's not doing anything. You know, he's just walking into the room. But if I don't know he's going to be there, then it really freaks me out. When there's a PTSD trigger, your hormones, they take over and the fear response kicks in and you don't think it out. You aren't considering what's going to happen next or what the results of your actions might be. You are in full out protective panic mode. The worst example of this for me was several years ago when I was married to, excuse me, but an asshole. You know, everybody has different views on what went wrong in a marriage or whatever, but it took those years of therapy to look back and realize that he was narcissistic and he was gaslighting me a lot. So he would deliberately pick fights with me and up my stress. There was one incident in particular that was just beyond awful. My husband was a Costa Rican firefighter. He was informed of my triggers. And one of those triggers is a certain pitch of noise. Like it resembles a child's high-pitched scream. Like you hear kids playing on the playground and they scream that weird reverberating pitch. And like that pitch really sets me off, so much so that my children knew you do not scream unless something is trying to eat you, because I will come flying out of the house ready to kill something. I mean, that is the reaction I get when I hear that pitch. The whistle that the firefighters gave my husband had that same pitch. And he blew it out in the yard. I got that panic feeling. You know, this was across the yard. And I said, please, please don't blow that whistle around me. Okay. That's a trigger. Please don't. It wasn't very long after I asked him very nicely to please not blow that whistle around me. I was in the living room working on a project on my computer. He walked right behind me about a foot from my head and blew that whistle. And I lost all control of my own mouth and my own behavior. I jumped out of the chair. I flung the chair across the room. I began shouting obscenities at him, obscenities that I do not use. I mean, I don't call people horrible names. I don't swear at people. And I just lost it. And I grabbed a pen and I ran at him. And he ran out the door with this look of terror on his face. Because like I said, this is not me. I am not a violent person. I don't attack people. And I chased him out the door with a pen, screaming at him that he was a motherfucker. And I just don't even know. There was such horrible things coming out of my mouth. And I slammed the door so hard that it broke a window pane. And then I went into the room and it took me a while to pull it together. I was so embarrassed and so just horrified at my own behavior. And my children were in the other room when all this happened. My children were in there hearing me say these things and acting like a complete lunatic. I felt so awful. I felt so ashamed about my behavior. And now that I better understand complex post-traumatic stress disorder, I understand that at that moment, I had absolutely no control over my behavior, or the words coming out of my mouth. I really had no control. And I could not have stopped myself. It's a really good thing that my ex ran out that door. Because had he confronted me, I might have stabbed him with the throat with a pen. I don't know what might have happened. The last thing I want to do in this world is hurt another human being, either emotionally or physically. And the event really, really scared me. The things that took place during that relationship also required therapy to get through. Another weird thing, which I'm sure is tied to the PTSD, I wake up if somebody comes in and watches me sleep. This is something that's happened my entire life. A person can come in and just look at me while I'm asleep, and I will wake up and be like, what do you want? The other things are extreme sensitivity to odors. I can detect odors and notice things that a lot of people don't. So it's sort of hyper aware of everything. I'm aware of facial expressions also. So I'm constantly paying attention to what is going on around me and constantly trying to adjust my behavior so that I am not somehow bothering those around me. This has been something that I've worked with my therapist on a lot. Something my therapist tells me often is learn to take up space. And in this pandemic, it has been illuminating to see how many people just don't pay any attention at all to the other human beings around them. All these people not wearing masks because, frankly, they just don't care what happens to the person next to them. They don't care if their actions are disrupting somebody or upsetting someone or inconveniencing anyone. They just don't care. It's a really weird thing to me because I've been so hyper aware of everybody my entire life. But I guess that's what happens when your father's a narcissist and you have to deal with that and you have to navigate in a way so as not to upset him or trigger some sort of a outburst. So basically, that is what I've been dealing with my entire life. I finally got a therapist who understood childhood trauma and understood how PTSD manifests in someone who was traumatized by a caregiver, somebody who never got to establish a normal before experiencing the trauma. And that is the huge difference between your PTSD that you get from going to war and your PTSD that happens from childhood abuse and neglect. When it happens because you went to war, let's hope you had a solid foundation of understanding your relationship with your family and your community, and you felt safe in that at one time. So then you go to a war zone and you're exposed to these horrors and stuff, and it twists the way your mind processes things and it affects the way you react to everything. However, you still have that baseline of security somewhere in the back of your mind that hopefully through therapy, you can revert and get back to that. That being said, psychedelics help heal that trauma too, very well. But when that trauma starts because of something that was done to you by the very people who society expects to love you the most and care for and nurture you and make sure that you're safe and nothing bad happens to you, when that person is instead the one who victimizes you, it really fucks up your view of the world in a way that makes it really hard for anybody to understand if they haven't gone through this. It is okay to not have a relationship with people who mistreated you, with people who didn't have your best interests at heart, with people who having a continued relationship with them would further damage your psyche. It is perfectly acceptable for you to walk away from that. It's okay. It took me a long time to get to that point where I actually did it. That childhood trauma set me up to have a lot of problems in life. I didn't know who to trust. As a child, I had to trust people who weren't trustworthy. So my gut feeling of who to trust and who to avoid was actually spot on. It was absolutely, it still is. If my gut says that person is sketchy in some way, and I have absolutely no evidence whatsoever to support that feeling, I still follow it. Because when I was a child, I got that feeling too. But I got that feeling about my parents. And you're not allowed to have that feeling about your parents. You're not allowed to have that view. You can't just walk away from your parents. You can't say, hey, you know what? I remember the last time you lied and said we were going to Disneyland, but we weren't going to Disneyland, so I don't want to take this trip. You don't get that option. You're a child. Everything is completely out of your control. So what you have to do is walk on eggshells and do the very best you can to anticipate the next shoe that drops, to anticipate the next tantrum your father throws, or the next mood your mother is in, or to anticipate that, you know, maybe now is a good time to duck out and go hide out in a room because somebody's upset about something and you're going to somehow be held responsible. There are some of you out there listening to this. If you were raised by a narcissist or somebody with a borderline personality disorder or something like that, maybe you understand where I'm coming from. Luckily, it seems most people at least believe that their parents really love them. And even though they make mistakes, they've got their best interests at heart and they're really trying. And let's face it, you don't get an instruction book with your kids. There's one thing when you screw up not knowing what you're doing, and there's another thing when it's just clearly neglectful and you're using your child to serve your purposes and not doing what's best for your child. That kind of gets into the weeds about why my anxiety was so high and why I needed so much counseling, and all that may have resulted in the fibromyalgia. There are theories that fibromyalgia is not only trauma-related, but also related to your adrenal glands. When you are in constant fear, you have all of those hormones that come with fear, and it programs your brain so that it doesn't really know how to relax. It doesn't know how not to be afraid. Years of therapy have helped a great deal, but it didn't change that hormonal response to stress. I got to a point where I felt like I had talked through the depression and the abuse and all of these things that led me to feel the way I feel and react the way that I react, trying to understand myself better so that I can hopefully move past this. How do you get to the point where you no longer have this in the back of your mind, that it doesn't control your behavior, it doesn't control your relationships with others? I didn't know what would fix this. So basically, I had a psychologist who was wonderful, great counselor, but she was not a psychiatrist, which means she did not prescribe medication. So I was seeing this psychiatrist who kept bringing up, you know, you have anxiety. It's not just the depression. This anxiety is a thing. You know, you really should see about medicating for the anxiety. I realized that they were right. The anxiety was really affecting all aspects of my life. So I said, okay, fine, we can try an anti-anxiety medication.
We are going to take a short break for a word from our very first sponsor, Mooch's Munchies. Mooch's Munchies has not only agreed to sponsor us, but provide a helpful tip for your pets. So this week's tip is about gluten. What is wheat gluten? And why is it bad for cats and dogs? Put simply, gluten is a protein found in grain, but primarily in wheat. The term gluten actually means glue in Latin. Doesn't sound like something you want to eat. And it describes the glue-like texture that gives dough that elastic, easy-to-handle texture. Gluten is really a crude derivative of two proteins. One is called glutenin, and the other is gliadin, the latter being the part that creates negative reactions. To be clear, there are no recorded cases of outright celiac disease in dogs or cats, like in humans, but gliadin is a protein that neither dogs nor cats have the enzymes to effectively break down, due also in part to the relative shortness of their guts in relation to our own. The conditions encountered are more like an intolerance or sensitivity, but can lead to chronic small intestine inflammation, leading to problems like persistent diarrhea, abnormal weight gain, poor coat quality, malabsorption, chronic fatigue, and even depression in our pets. Why is this happening now as much as it is? Wheat has changed a great deal since after World War II. Use of GMOs, or hybridization of grains, current industrial methods of processing, and poorer overall diets are leading to the loss of nutrition and creating more acute autoimmune problems. Mooch's Munchies recommends going gluten-free for your dog or cat. Watch the ingredients in your food choices from commercial marketplaces. Protein is pushed heavily. And a food may be heavy in protein, but if the first five ingredients are anything related to wheat, that protein may be functionally useless to your dog or cat. Mooch's Munchies uses Bob's Red Mill gluten-free 1-to-1 baking flour for its real food treats and has everything from sweet to savory to even treats that will help with breath issues. They're located in Las Vegas, Nevada. But they are making their homemade treats available all over the United States. That's how I get Mooch's Munchies for my therapy dogs. They ship it right to me all the way from Las Vegas. And both Snacks, my original emotional support pet who is getting on in age, and Chewy, his young Padawan in training, both absolutely love Mooch's Munchies. Mooch's Munchies has a full-service, health-conscious pet company. They offer high-end foods for dogs and cats for the purpose of treating food like medicine, while still being fun. And I have to tell you, they're all made with great ingredients, so they're decent for human consumption too. And the cheesy cluckers are a pretty good substitute for those oyster crackers you put on soup. So if you have a dog or a cat with a sour tummy or weight issues or prone to pancreatitis problems, Mooch's Munchies has a solution that is simply real food, gluten-free, no chemical preservatives, and no fine print. And Mooch's Munchies is also a small business owned by a very lovely couple, and we are grateful that they have chosen to sponsor our pod and offer these lovely pet tips to benefit your fur babies too. Okay, now where were we? Agreeing to take medication for anxiety. I had been on various medications for depression for many, many years when I realized that yes, this anxiety is not normal. Most people can drive without thinking that the person next to them is judging their driving, apparently. I realized just how much it was impending on everything that I do, how I live my life, how often I go to the store because I just couldn't deal with all the people around me. And I just wanted to be happy and peaceful, and no medication was doing that for me. For those of you out there who have had to go through psychological medications, you know this. If you are not aware, basically it's kind of like being a guinea pig. They just, well, this might help you, and they give you something, and then you go back in a week or so and they ask how it's going, or if it doesn't work right away, you call them up and say, I am not taking this crap. And it didn't help my anxiety enough to make any of the side effects worth it. The first one didn't really help the anxiety hardly at all. The next one, it made me gain 10 pounds in like a week and a half. And that was one of the main things with all of the anxiety things. Whether they seemed to help a little bit or not, they always made me gain weight. So I don't know about you, but if you're a woman in your 40s, gaining weight is not going to help your anxiety. I'm just saying, it's not helpful. I've got the regular anxiety, and now I'm starting to feel anxiety about the weight gain. None of these anti-anxiety pills were working. There was one pill that seemed to reduce my anxiety to the point where, frankly, I didn't care about anything at all. I had zero motivation because I just didn't give a shit about anything. I am a creative person. And I like to create, even if I am not considered super productive by the rest of society because of my disabilities. I had zero motivation to create anything. I didn't even care about creating the meal we were going to have for dinner. I just did not care. That clearly was not a solution to my anxiety. What I was researching at that time was something called ayahuasca. Some of you may have heard about ayahuasca ceremonies. Ayahuasca is a medicinal tea that has been used in some cultures for spiritual awakenings, given to you by a shaman. You're monitored, and a lot of people who have PTSD, are dealing with trauma, have gone to places like Peru and participated in ayahuasca ceremony. And the point is to basically purge yourself of these feelings and thoughts. And a lot of people have had profound experiences that have helped them move past traumas with the use of ayahuasca. However, it's not exactly financially accessible to a lot of people, and I don't have access to it. So that would be great if you are somebody suffering from trauma who also happens to have a good income. I don't know, you're a trust fund baby. People of means can afford an ayahuasca trip. I am not a person of means. So that branched off into researching other psychedelics. And I discovered that there is a lot of buzz going on about psychedelics in the treatment of mental illness in general, but more specifically, post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety. It's an odd sort of a thing because mushrooms are both cutting edge and taboo in the psychiatric community at this moment in time. It's kind of trending. I mean, you may have heard about this recently. There have been a few news articles about it. Most recently, I actually listened to something called Newsy. It's like a news break thing that's supposed to be like not politically motivated. And they just basically give you these news clips. And they're Newsy news clips. They mentioned psychedelic mushrooms for treatment of depression. I was surprised. It's going more mainstream all the time. So when I informed my psychiatrist that I was investigating this, she was not at all open to the idea. I got a lot of warnings about contraindications of the psychological medication I was on, conflicting with possible mushroom use. And okay, I understand that's her profession and it is her job to prescribe for the pharmaceutical companies. However, I'd already tried their pharmaceuticals and she tried me on several that were not successful. So I continued my own research. I'm grateful that my psychologist, on the other hand, was doing her own research and she was actually looking into psychedelics in the treatment of mental health problems for people like me. So she actually shared with me links to some more information. And I started studying as much as I could about the different trials. Now, there are some problems with the use of psychedelics to treat your mental health issues. And the biggest one is they are still a Schedule I drug. So let's review what a Schedule I drug is. Under the Controlled Substance Act, a Schedule I drug is defined as illegal to cultivate or possess for either personal consumption or distribution. Schedule I drugs are substances or chemicals with no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. But we have things on that list of Schedule I drugs that do not fall under those categories. And the top of that list are cannabis and psychedelic mushrooms. The real crime in that is by making a drug Schedule I and saying that it has no legitimate medical purpose, it makes it nearly impossible to do studies in order to find out whether or not that is true. And the real irony, especially in the case of cannabis, is that they already knew that it had legitimate medicinal purposes before they classified it as a Schedule I. And the reason we know this is because prior to that classification, cannabis was in all kinds of medications. It was in cough syrup. It was in headache medication. It was in several pharmaceuticals that you could go down to your drugstore and get. It was really quite common. until they made it a Schedule One and said that it didn't have a legitimate medical purpose and they made it illegal to use it. They were also finding medicinal reasons to use psychedelics back in the 60s. Both of those substances were made illegal in large part because they were associated with counterculture. They were associated with the hippies who were protesting the war. They were associated with people of color. And by making them illegal, it made it easier to incarcerate these dissidents and, of course, the undesirable black man at the time. So the big fear of these two particular substances is manufacture. Some of the other things that make a drug dangerous are the potential for death. Like, can a person overdose on it and die? That, of course, should be taken into consideration before deciding whether or not a drug should be available to the public, either medicinally or for recreation. However, we have several drugs that are available pharmaceutically that are very, very addictive and very, very fatal. We know about the opioid epidemic that has swept this country and how many people have family members who have overdosed or become addicted and gotten arrested because they no longer have access to their medication through their doctor, so they wind up using it illegally or using substances that are opioids, but they're not prescription, and then they wind up getting into legal problems on top of the health problems that they're getting from taking these particular drugs. In the history of cannabis use, nobody has overdosed and died on it. It's important to know that. Cannabis is also not physically addictive. Neither are mushrooms. Magic mushrooms are considered not addictive. They don't cause compulsive use. The human body quickly builds a tolerance. It would be extremely difficult to have any effect after 4 days of repeated use of magic mushrooms. They also have a low toxicity rate. The cases of death are extremely rare. According to researchers at Johns Hopkins University, they suggest a reclassification as a Schedule 4 drug for medical use to treat depression, anxiety, and substance use disorders. So even Johns Hopkins believes that psychedelics should be a Schedule 4, not a Schedule 1. And how beneficial they are to us for mental disorders can't possibly be gauged or understood until they change the scheduling and make it possible for researchers to investigate their effects out in the open. There are a lot of therapists basically investigating this on the down low because they cannot come out in their practice and say, yes, I offer therapy that uses psychedelics to make it easier to process trauma. They can't do that because they will risk their license. So the buzz in the psychiatric community are psychedelic drugs like LSD, psilocybin, or magic mushrooms, MDMA, also known as ecstasy, and marijuana, more accurately, cannabis, and we mentioned earlier, ayahuasca. All of these are being used, at least experimentally, in the treatment of depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. I told you about that wonderful therapist that I have, and most recently, she suggested a very recent Fresh Air podcast, and it was an interview with the psychiatrist Julie Holland. She recently released a new book called Good Chemistry. And in the interview, she talked about how these drugs assist therapy because they offer a feeling of unity and connection. This altered perception is especially beneficial in therapy for trauma, which of course is the root of post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Holland and other therapists like her believe that these drugs may offer a revolutionary way to treat trauma, and in just one session, they can leave the client with a profound benefit that would otherwise take years of cognitive therapy to reach. There's a paradox, however. And that is for those who have been using antidepressants for years, which are many of us. In particular, it's the SSRIs. When a person ingests psilocybin mushrooms or magic mushrooms or shrooms, the psilocybin converts to psilocin, which binds to the 5-HT2C receptors in the brain. This receptor regulates neurotransmitter chemicals that control feelings of appetite and cognition, anxiety, imagination, mood, and perception. So it is a paradox for those on antidepressants because they need to go off of the SSRIs in order to experience this. And clearly, that is something that needs to be monitored by a therapist. You can't just go off these willy-nilly. They need to be weaned off those in order to have this experience. And it kind of depends on the SSRI you're on. In my case, the one that I was on was Wellbutrin, also known by the generic bupropion. Luckily, bupropion doesn't have a long, what did they call it, half-life, which means within about 36 hours, you can work most of it out of your system and enough of it out of your system to have some successful experience with microdosing the shrooms. Now, the really fascinating thing for me in doing this research was to learn that those advertisements that they just drilled into us in the 80s about how dangerous drugs were and just say no to drugs. And there was a particularly common commercial, and that was the one, I don't know if you remember, this egg, and it'd say, "This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs." And it would crack the egg into the pan and it would fry on the pan. And like, don't do drugs, just say no, right? Well, here's the real irony. They are finding that these psychedelics actually facilitate neuroplasticity or synaptogenesis and neurogenesis, the formation of new brain cells. So not only is LSD, magic mushrooms, all of those things that we were told damage our brain, not only are they not causing damage, they are actually repairing the pathways in our brains. And that to me was the biggest reason why I said, I got to figure out how to get my hands on this and do it. Because throughout this process of recovering, the one thing I heard again and again and again is that if a child doesn't strengthen certain pathways in their brain when they're developing, and especially prior to age three, there's a real tight window in development. And they say that if you do not experience love before age three, you can't understand it. You can't process it. The pathways in your brain that make that connection, that understand a loving, nurturing relationship, they say they can't be rebuilt if those pathways weren't built up by age three. And there's a lot of development that takes place in those initial formative years and how you process everything for the rest of your life. And some of those other pathways that you hear about are like language, which is why if a child is exposed to multiple languages at a young age, even if they don't learn those languages when they're really young, they often find it easier to learn languages when they're older because those pathways in the brain recognize the language and those sounds. So in understanding this brain development, I had a great deal of dismay that my brain wasn't able to develop properly because of the trauma that I experienced, and I was going to be damaged forever. That's a hard concept to accept and move on from, to be like, yeah, my brain's fucked up and there's nothing I can do about it. Yeah, pretty helpless feeling. So when I heard about the neuroplasticity aspect and the fact that it might actually reconnect things and get your brain to process things in a new way, that was the ultimate seller for me. So I started doing not only the research into what was possible, but how the heck do I get my hands on these, right? I mean, I we'd go to music festivals and stuff. And yeah, a situation like that, sometimes they're available. You gotta look for the guy who looks like a wizard. I don't know. And I actually did try them at a music festival a couple years back with zero effect. Didn't realize then that it was because of the SSRI that I was taking. So, armed with this new knowledge, I went on a quest to see about where and how I could get my hands on these magic mushrooms. Because of this experimentation into the possible health benefits, and also a whole lot of people becoming more knowledgeable about the fact that they really don't fall under the category of Schedule One. I mean, they're not particularly dangerous. More and more people are like, okay, why are they illegal? Maybe they shouldn't be. So, in the United States, it's not easy to get your hands on these substances, and they are not widely available. However, magic mushrooms are already legal in Brazil, Bulgaria, Jamaica, the Netherlands, and Samoa, and certain US cities are catching up. In May of 2019, Denver, Colorado passed Ordinance 301, which makes shrooms the lowest law enforcement priority. Oakland, California passed a similar resolution the following month. And then in January of 2020, Santa Cruz, California voted unanimously to decriminalize possession and cultivation. Right now, 2020, Oregon has a ballot initiative that could make shrooms legal under licensed therapeutic conditions. So, moving in the direction of being able to allow therapists to use these psychedelics in their practice. So, I saw that one of these places where it's legal is Oakland, California. Well, not legal, but decriminalized. And I happen to live in the East Bay Area, not far from Oakland. However, it wasn't particularly easy to find a place where I could procure them. In fact, I did some internet research. I wasn't really finding what I was looking for. I discovered a source quite accidentally. I was surfing Facebook and it clicked for some reason that a friend of mine back in my hometown posted a lot of mushroom pictures, like a lot of photographs of mushrooms in the woods, mushroom drawings, mushrooms dancing, lots and lots of mushroom pictures. So I was like, So I messaged him on the side and I was like, dude, I know this is kind of out of the blue, but I noticed that you tend to post a lot of mushroom photos and I'm in this situation where I'm trying to get my hands on some shrooms to try to help me medicinally. And it was really interesting because he right away sent me his phone number. It's like, call me, you have to call me. So I call him up and he's like, oh my gosh, I was just listening to this podcast on Joe Rogan about how helpful psychedelics can be to people with post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety and depression. And he knew a little bit about my past, that these are some things that I have been processing and dealing with for a while. He said, well, I happen to know a guy who used to live up here, but lives in the Bay Area, and he's a member of this church that uses medicinal mushrooms and cannabis, and he can hook you up and get you in there so you can sign up. So I connected with this guy and I met him and I got to go to this church. The church is also a dispensary, it's both, and it allows you to use these substances under your own understanding of them and in your own way. One of the nicest things about this place is they take the experience of using mushrooms very seriously. They give you a little pamphlet that spells out, what is a microdose, what's a normal dose, what would be like a mega dose, so that you know what you're ingesting. They have suggestions about your surroundings in order to make things safe, about how much you should use, how often you should use, what you should do prior to, set aside your time, what kind of music to listen. I mean, they're very specific on making sure that the experience you have is as beneficial as possible. This isn't just some random person handing you a handful of mushrooms at a music festival and you know what kind of mushrooms they are or how you should take them or how long they will last or any of that stuff. But in this case, they do a lot to inform you. And there are a lot of varieties of magic mushrooms too. So you kind of have to see what works for you. The very first time I went in, I got a fairly common type of psilocybin mushroom called Cambodian. And they're these kind of spindly small mushrooms. So rather than try to relate to you my first experience from memory, I actually went about this kind of scientifically and I documented my experience. So I'm going to read to you what I wrote. And I have to say, my timing in deciding to pursue this and use these mushrooms could not have been better, because this pandemic has sent everybody's anxiety through the roof. So those who actually have a diagnosed anxiety disorder, we are suffering more than the average person, and I think my suffering has been greatly reduced by the use of magic mushrooms. So, my first experience, Sunday, March 15th, 2020. After a week of microdosing Cubanis Cambodian, or Cambodian mushrooms, I had my first magic mushroom experience. I'm feeling tired and having fibromyalgia pain this morning, but it was a very productive experience. However, I think this particular variety makes me feel sleepy and tight in my chest. I look forward to trying a different variety next time. A week or so ago, a friend of mine gave me the contact info for his friend John in Oakland. I met with him at a church of entheogenic plants called Zydor. Magic mushrooms were decriminalized in the area a year or two ago. We got $120 worth. Yeah, they're expensive. Last Saturday, I tried some, but the Wellbutrin was still in my system. The rest of the week, I had a cap or a stem each day with no psych meds. It was a moody week, but it was also PMS week. Take that as you will. Yesterday morning, we went to brunch at this place called Market Tavern that has great organic food. Around 4 p.m., we made a mango smoothie, and I added 0.2 grams of ground Cambodian to mine. It took a while to kick in, and we decided to watch some Guardians of the Galaxy. Around 6:30, I was feeling a little weird, and the movie seemed too intense, so we took a walk in the rain. It was cold, and we needed to bundle up. For some reason, my boyfriend put on 3 layers, including this hideously yellow raincoat that his mom had given him. The color seemed insanely orange, and the whole layers and the coat set me into a laughing fit on the way out the door. The world looks very different on shrooms. We walked around the fake lake here at the apartment complex. The water looked weirdly flat, even with the water droplets breaking the surface. The green of the grass and the weeping willows were really intense, and for some reason, all orange is crazy bright, so the flowers were amazing. When we got back, I discovered my spiral spiritual paintings are wild on shrooms. So let me amend that. I mentioned before that I like to paint, and one of the things that I do is I paint these multicolored paintings that are sort of like a spiral shape with the colors coming out, and I offer them on my Etsy page, Esperanza Paints. I had no idea that when you take psychedelics, these paintings like self-animate, so that was very cool. Back to my account. The colors kept spiraling around each other, swirling out, shifting to other colors, and vibrating. I kept asking David to look at it, but obviously he couldn't see what I was seeing. I was sleepy and wanted to lay down, so we went and laid down in bed. But I took one of my paintings off the wall and hung it so that I could watch it from bed. We put on some music, something tranquil that didn't have any words. We tried something with words that didn't go well. It was a profoundly emotional experience for me. I felt like all was right with me for the first time, like ever. I had no self-judgment. I felt loved, and my mind drifted to the people who believed in me, my friends like Monica and Melissa and Casey and Shannon. See, that's the thing. Thinking about it, I can remember the experience and I get emotional again. I found myself wanting my daughters to experience this amazing feeling. Both of my daughters suffer from anxiety. Along with a feeling of love and connection, I was feeling grief and sadness for never having felt this accepted or loved before by anyone, including myself. I cried for a while out of both joy and sadness. It was a very cleansing cry, and I felt lighter afterwards. Also, during the course of the shroom's effects, I had to urinate so often. I don't know if that's a mushroom thing. It might have just been me. But like every 10 minutes during the movie. I have no idea why. My boyfriend ordered some DoorDash, and I had a little to eat around 9:30. By then, the mushrooms had worn off. We finished the movie and then watched Avatar. Wound up not getting to bed until after midnight. I slept okay, not long enough, which is typical of me. I felt tired all day, but now that I've had lunch, I'm laying down for a nap. We'll have to wait and see whether there are long-term benefits from this experience. So that was my very first psychedelic experience with magic mushrooms. And as I said, it was profound, and it has had a lasting impact. I wouldn't say it's 100%. I still have my anxieties. However, my anxieties are greatly reduced. Since then, I am more aware that I am feeling anxious. I am more aware that that anxiety is building, because it used to be that anxiety was the normal homeostasis for me. I was just ordinarily anxious and preoccupied. That was my normal state. And since that experience, when that happens, when it starts to build, I think, oh, well, that's an anxiety response. Maybe my reaction is being over the top for this particular situation. We can make this happen. It's not a big deal. I notice over time, that anxiety tends to get a little bit worse. And when I feel that happening, I microdose. I take like 0.1 grams of mushrooms. And I also find that it has changed the way that I look at these things and how I process them, because I am looking back at events in my past, experiences that I had, and thinking, oh, yeah, I was feeling a lot of anxiety in that moment. And it's made something else very real for me. There's been lots of things that I have done in my life that other people think is brave or sometimes crazy. You're like, oh my gosh, how could you just pick up and drive all the way to Canada when you were 16 years old? Was kind of nuts. I agree with that. However, the reason why is because I had anxiety about absolutely everything. So if going to school to take a test caused me extreme anxiety, it didn't cause me any more anxiety than packing up my car and driving to another country with 25 bucks in my pocket. Those were equal anxiety to me. I was operating on such a level of panic and stress that these dramatic life choices that other people look at and say, wow, oh my gosh, picked up your kids and you moved to Costa Rica? Yeah, that was freaky. However, if I had packed up my kids and moved to Sacramento, I would have been equally freaked out. It wasn't any higher level of stress or anxiety than any other event in my life. That has changed. That chemistry in my brain has been altered, I hope, forever. Hopefully that extreme anxiety stuff will not come back. Only time will tell. I am so fortunate to live in a part of the country where this medicine was accessible to me. It has been, sorry, I'm going to get emotional again. This experience has been nothing short of miraculous. I mean, fucking miraculous. I have been dealing with these feelings and emotions and trauma as long as I can remember. And I feel like I am finally on my way to healing my brain, healing my psyche, and moving on. I have to say, if I had not decided to do this psychological experiment with psychedelics, this podcast wouldn't exist. That's a fact. Because that anxiety has held me back for so, so long in so many creative endeavors, things that I wanted to do, but just felt completely helpless to make it happen. And any little setback would derail my project completely. But my brain is healthier now. I'm able to better cope with stress, and I am better able to forgive myself when I screw up. I mean, let's face it, whenever you're going to do something that you've never done before, you have to learn new skills. That is one of the things too that would paralyze me. It's like, what if I fail? What if I'm not able to do this? What if I'm not smart enough? I'm not good enough. I can't figure it out. What if I can't figure it out? And that fear alone would often prevent me from even trying. But I now can say, so what? I might fail. This podcast could be a massive failure that nobody listens to. But you know what they say of really, really successful people in this world? Most of them have failed at more things than most people will ever try in their lifetime. So I'm able to say, hey, failure may just be one of those steps you have to take on the way to success. Thank you so much for joining me to get into the weeds about shrooms and allowing me to share my profound experience using psychedelics to help my lifelong mental illness. I hope you learned something. I hope it inspires you to do some research on your own if you also suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, or depression, and have used other therapies to limited success. If you agree that this medicine should be made available for more people who are suffering from these disorders, please write to your congressperson, write to your local officials, encourage them to take John Hopkins' advice and change these substances to Schedule 4 so that more research can be done and we can find out what the true benefits are and how they function to help heal the brain. Thank you. Before we finish off today's pod, I have one more thing to add. As I was editing the pod and preparing to release it, I got some very tragic news. In my last pod, I mentioned that the Goo Ball King of the Grateful Dead was still around, and sadly, that is no longer the case. My dear friend Mountain, aka the Goo Ball King, passed away this weekend. Mountain is going to be missed by so, so many people, especially musicians in the community of Calaveras and Tuolumne County. Mountain was an amazing man. He managed to survive the horrors of Vietnam. He saw some of the very worst of humanity. Somehow he turned that around and was able to offer the best of humanity to those who were fortunate enough to know him. I hope that there's an afterlife. If there is, you know that Mountain is up there listening to some great tunes and sharing a bowl with Jerry Garcia. So, farewell, Goo Ball King. We're going to miss you. That's going to end the pod for today. Thank you so much for joining us for Unpacking Life's Crazy. Please like and subscribe to be notified when a new pod drops. And as always, if you're interested in learning more about this podcast, please visit my website, esperanzaphoenix.com. Last but not least, I would like to offer a special thanks to Chelsea Wild, the talented musician who composed the theme music for this pod. To find more of her wonderful original music, you can look her up on Instagram at minor.birds or visit minorbirds.info. That's minorbirds.info. Thank you so much for listening to the pod today. We hope you'll listen next time. Have an amazing day.